And as you can tell, I am not Ted Maxwell. My name's Matt Neely. I'm sitting in for Ted, who's having a well-deserved vacation. Hope you're having a good time, Ted, wherever you may be. Today on The Morning Voice, I've got Greg Gehringer here helping out behind the glass. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
And at 6:45, we're going to be talking to 7:45, we're going to be talking to Adrian Wuhr with the Hedrick Acres Neighborhood Association about the recent appeal against the city of Tucson to deal with a homeless encampment. 8 o'clock, we got Marie Fordney and Alan Michaels from the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona. Tell us about what they do. And 8:30, we're looking forward to meeting Ed Carnes with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. How are you this morning, Greg?
I am good.
We got a little baseball coming up later this week.
Yes, we do. The Cats will be playing North Carolina in the Super Regionals, and the winner of that match will face off against, Coastal Carolina and Auburn.
Okay. Yeah. So there's four. I thought it's not a best of three over
it's
there?
It's a best of three. That's right. Okay. So not the winner of that, but the winner of that series.
Oh, okay.
And then that's the Super Regional, and then the winner of that will go on to Omaha.
Got it. Okay. I didn't know if they punched their ticket, if they just beat University of North Carolina, but that's they had quite a weekend. Their bats exploded against Utah Valley and Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, the sister college to my alma mater, the sister campus to my alma mater in Cal Poly Pomona. 28 runs in two games, 14 games apiece, and a whole slew of like 14 home runs, I think.
Yes, they were hitting them out of the park, and they set that record on Saturday for the most home runs in a game in Wildcat history.
8 home runs, and 3 by one on Saturday, and then 3 by another player on Sunday. So they just went crazy.
And I just can't say enough good stuff about Chip Hale. I don't think a lot of people in Tucson appreciate him enough. What a great hire he was for the university.
Yeah.
And the future of that program looks bright. And a lot of people don't know Chip's background. You know, Chip was a Wildcat, played there. He won a championship, I think, in 86.
86, okay.
And then played with the Twins and the Dodgers. Didn't get a ton of MLB time, but then, you know, managed as a bench coach and a third base coach for a bunch of teams. Did manage the Diamondbacks for 2 years. A lot of people don't remember that.
I'd forgotten about that.
Which, you know, that was the organization. He did have a sub-500 record and was fired after two seasons, but that wasn't his fault. And he won a ring with the Washington Nationals in 2019.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, They're playing very well at the time of the season where you want to play well.
Absolutely. I mean, I genuinely think they have a real, real shot. North Carolina's tough.
They're ranked fifth, and they're slotted fifth in the NCAA tournament this year, right? So it's not going to be a pushover. And, you know, frankly, Arizona had to played some smaller colleges, maybe with not as deep a bullpen. You were telling me yesterday, or Ed, I think maybe Ed Alexander commented that the Cal Poly coach said, look, our bullpen just can't, we don't have the depth of bullpen to make this happen.
No, they're part of the Big West, of course, which, you know, does have some decent baseball teams.
Sure.
UC Irvine is part of that conference, excuse me.
And going way back, UC Riverside had a great baseball legacy. Cal Poly Pomona with John Scalinos had a great baseball legacy. I remember meeting Jerry Kendall some time ago, obviously, and he asked me where I'd gone to school, and I told him, and he was a great admirer of John Scalinos, who was the longtime baseball coach at Cal Poly Pomona. So certainly a great legacy and on the West Coast of baseball.
And it's another one of those conferences, like the Big West, the WCC that Gonzaga and St. Mary's are part of, the WAC, not the WAC we remember from back in the day, but the current WAC that has Grand Canyon and a few other schools. These are all schools that play D1 basketball, and they have some, you know, men's soccer teams and things like that, but none of them have football teams.
Mm-hmm.
But again, all those schools you just mentioned do generally excel in baseball. They're able to at least put athletic department resources towards that sport.
And you remind me a little bit of the Pac-10 or 12 or whatever, the Pacific Athletic Conference is growing. So they've just announced San Diego State, Boise State,
Colorado State. And New Mexico.
And New Mexico. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I've forgotten that one. And then Gonzaga is going to join them for basketball, which...
That's
so
right.
They're putting the pieces back together with Oregon State and Washington State.
I've had some Pac-12 posts show up in my Facebook feed.
Yeah.
So the Pac-12 social media crew are really trying to... advertise and let everyone know, we're still here. We're growing. we're going to be back.
We have money, you know, as Oregon State and Washington State found out, they did leave money behind that they were beneficiaries of.
But it's ironic because the Pac-12 is less than 12. And yes, you've got all the other conferences like the Big Ten and the Big 12 that are way more than that number.
They have to learn how to spell a number like B-I-G or and call it the Big Ten with 18 schools or whatever they are. They're going to have to find out a clever way to call themselves the Pac-12.
But it's possible by 2030 the Pac-12 will have 12 teams.
It could be. Who knows with all the realignment. I mean, just the brand legacy, I think, is decent. So I would imagine they'd be able to kind of put the pieces back together. I know San Diego State had said that they would not leave, but I guess they had a change of heart. Probably they started thinking about
well,
money.
You know, it's kind of like I really felt bad. I think you and I both did for Washington State and Oregon State getting left behind because these were not crappy schools.
No.
These were not crappy programs. But it just seemed like the Big 12, you know, wanted what they wanted. The Big 10 wanted what they wanted. And those guys got left behind. And at the same time, I kind of feel bad because the Mountain West was not a Power 5, you know, or Power 4 conference. But they were still a good conference.
Yes, right.
And so what they were advertising actually in this social media post was for football, the winning percentage of the teams that are joining combined with Oregon State and Washington State over the last five seasons, they had like a 700 winning percentage.
Oh my.
So yeah that actually plays
out. I was just kind of wondering, like, you know, UNLV, Nevada, and Hawaii, those might be good additions if they could pull that one off, because people in, I've talked to you about this in the past, but if you talk to people in Hawaii, their favorite place to go is Las Vegas. Just, they got island fever. They just want to go and they
do
love to go to Las Vegas.
Yeah, there's just something about Hawaiians. You're right. It is the island fever.
I think it would be possibly a good fit for the conference and then build it back up to 10 or 12 teams. So anyway, yeah, the Cats are going to be playing baseball. And, you know, they say weather could be a factor in the North Carolina super regionals with them. They said that there's a better than 50% or 50% or better chance of thunderstorms, rain. And, you know, southeast rain is a little bit different than here. Here it rains for 10 minutes and everybody gets on with their life. There, when it rains, it comes down a lot and
although
makes fields sloppy.
The irony is, I thought about this, there wasn't a lot of talk, but let's say Tucson had gotten that regional. The game on Sunday night would have been rained out, as where it wasn't in Eugene.
You're right. irony of ironies, right? And real quickly, just to tie a bow on the regionals conversation, you said that there was a good breeze going from home plate out to the field, which
pretty much for 2 or 3 days.
The home run
it did.
Output.
It did definitely. But I don't. You know, it wasn't as if all the other teams were hitting them out of the park at the rate Arizona was.
Well, yeah, that's true.
So
that's true. Something else that's kind of in the public consciousness right now that I wanted to talk about. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Greg, but there's this eagle nest camera in Big Bear Lake, California. And
Big Bear, I've heard about it.
Big
Bear
is just north of San Bernardino Redlands. Skiing up there, there's a lake fishing, and people go up there for the weekends and all that just to cool off. Well, they've had a camera in this eagle nest. I guess they've had it there for several years, but this year it's really caught on with people. They went through the hatching. You know, the parents, you know, protecting the eggs, the hatching, the initial feeding. Well, the first eagle fledged yet. There were three born, three hatched. One of them died. The eagle, Sunny, fledged yesterday. And so I know about this because that camera is on in my house for months now, all day long. So my wife is just fascinated with this. And I have to admit, it's really interesting to watch. So one of the eagles fledged yesterday morning, and it was all over the news, especially in Southern California, because tens of thousands of people are following this.
That's
They've got a YouTube live feed going all day long.
Yeah, it's the Facebook friends of mine that I've worked with in radio over the years that are now SoCal residents. They're always posting that on Facebook.
So it's really quite the story. So Sunny fledged, Sunny's little, they think they're both sisters. Gizmo is still in the nest, And so the, it was just kind of interesting because Sonny flew off and Gizmo looked around and was like, what, you can do that? You know? And so it went over to a nearby tree and the parents were over there around sunset yesterday, roosted in the tree where the where Sonny had fledged off to. And so we'll see. We'll have to see how Gizmo does now that the nest is emptying out. And Sonny now has to figure out how to eat because now, you know, it's not going to be Grubhub anymore from mom and dad bringing him fish or her fish. So it'll be interesting. But anyway, it's really caught the public consciousness. So good for you, Sonny and Gizmo. We have ultimate faith in you that you can fledge and become a great member of the Eagle community. Speaking of community, we're going to be talking civic engagement and we're going to be heading for a break here and take a brief break. When we come back, I would like to talk about everybody wants to stick their hand in your pocket and it's taxes and you're getting hit from all sides. So we'll talk about that when we come back on The Morning Voice. Tower of Power. Thank you, Greg Gerringer. Appreciate that. Love Tower of Power. Oh my gosh. I've seen them a bunch of times. What a great band.
And well, talking about hands in
what's
your pocket.
And the name of the song, Greg?
Of course, Taxed to the Max.
That's right. That's where we're at. 7:19, you're listening to The Morning Voice. Matt Neely sitting in for Ted Maxwell today, who is having some fun this summer. And so hope you are out there having a good time today, too, listening to the show. If you'd like to call in and get on the conversation, 520-790-2040. That's 790-2040. The Morning Voice has five different hosts on five different days. Monday, we have Lydia Aranda. She'd had a great conversation with the Community Food Bank yesterday. Today is civic engagement, normally with Ted Maxwell. Wednesday, Grant Kruger with Food for Talk or Food for Thought. Thursday, Tom Moulton talking about tourism, attractions, all sorts of fun stuff that's going on in Tucson. And Friday, Dr. Ed Ackerley talks about business success stories and University of Arizona wonder stories. A lot of good stuff going on at the U of A. A lot of interesting stuff going on at the U of A. So the old David Letterman joke is that it's so cold outside that lawyers have their hands in their own pockets, right? Well, so now we are at the point where the COVID hangover has hit all sorts of layers of government. And everybody is coming to you saying, we just got a few bucks. We just want you to pay. So here we go. We're going to do a quick rundown because it does add up. So first of all, the city of Tucson is raising water rates if you do not live inside the city limits, which is convenient because you can't like vote out the city council who voted to raise your water rates because you don't live in the city limits. Paul Cunningham, he was on with Ted Maxwell last week. He said it's about $8 a month for a typical customer. It's the second attempt to raise water rates after the first one was a judge told him the first attempt was illegal in 2023. It was an illegal rate structure that they collected rates on that we still haven't gotten. Those of us who were hit with the illegal rates still have not gotten a refund. I don't know how that works. Well, this time they're saying it's more expensive to deliver water to people outside of the city limits. Now, I find that sort of capricious on some levels because, well, face it, Bustos Media, KVOI, is in a county island. So you're going to tell me it costs them more money to send water to us than it does just to the east, north, or south of us. Go figure. That doesn't make any sense. We're going to be paying more money for our water because we're outside of the city limits. And there are some county pockets. I think there's another one up by Campbell and Fort Lowell, that street that has all the dirt roads. I think that's actually county. And there's numerous, I think, county islands that are surrounded by city. And so now they're telling them that it costs more to pump it to you, but the people past you on the line, it costs less. Makes no sense. The other thing was, I asked Paul Cunningham about this last week, and he really didn't have an answer. In June 2021, the city council said they were going to take in $9.9 million annually estimated for their last attempt at differential water rates. And they said that they had that for three spending areas: low-income assistance, climate resiliency, and infrastructure upgrades. Well, you know, that tells me that their whole idea for this is a wealth redistribution scheme. This is total Robin Hood stuff. And it just now they're coming back saying, no, it costs more to send the water to non-city addresses. I don't know. It seems like they're using it as a slush fund to me to redistribute your money. Climate resiliency, that does not have anything to do with pumping water to your house. And infrastructure upgrades, look, there was one along Sunrise Skyline Road last year. Okay, that may be out of the city. It seems like every other month there's one going on. There's a water main going out along 22nd or Broadway. Look, all the water mains are old. The infrastructure is challenged. I certainly don't know if there's any way that they can go about sending something through the line to check the health of lines, or if there's any sort of testing they can do to predict when these things are going to fail so they don't take out an entire major intersection when they go down. But my point is, there are infrastructure issues all over the system inside and outside of the city. In January 2022, the Star said that the city had to change its plan. They adopted changes to improve access to Tucson's water low-income program, again, while providing emergency assistance to customers experiencing hardship. Again, this has nothing to do with the fact that, it costs more money to send water to an address along River Road than it does along, Pima Road. It just seems... like it's a wealth redistribution scheme by the city. And so that's one tax hike. The other tax hike we have is the city of Tucson is talking about a property tax hike. KGON reported that city leaders are proposing a 6.61% increase in their primary property tax. Paul Cunningham was quoted in the story as saying it's offset by a decrease in the city's secondary property tax. He said, quote, we've retired some debt. We haven't borrowed as much money, and we haven't lost as much as court. Well, if you stick around till 7:45, and when we talk to the Hedrick Acres folks, Adrian from the Hedrick Acres Neighborhood Association, their luck may be about to change because of that, because the neighbors finally won in court, and they're going to get the city to the court's going to force the city to be held accountable for the homeless encampment and the way it's affecting other people's quality of life. So, hold your horses on that one, Councilman. Your winning streak in court might be over. Then TUSD voted last week to spend $1 million for a special election to raise your property taxes to fund a budget override. $17 a month for the owner of a $200,000 home, $70 a month for the owner of a $500,000 business. Now, it's a $500,000 business. That is definitely a small business.
Yeah.
Right. $70 a month. Just wham. You're going to get tagged for that.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Like not to jump back, but to the property taxes, some of those homeowners that are struggling just to keep up, bit of extra money that's going to have to be escrowed to pay those taxes, you know, will make a difference.
Right. The house payment goes up. Right. And they keep talking about people living on the edge and people living on the edge of homelessness. Well, they're creating more homeless people.
That's true. And you know, I don't want to see anybody become homeless, situationally homeless, not the fentanyl addicts, but those that actually do because everything falls apart. But just what I think about are those people that are trying to stay in the middle class.
Right.
You know, wife's busting her butt working. The husband's out busting his butt working. These are consumers and they're struggling. And that little $60 a month can add up.
Well,
yeah,
your groceries aren't getting any cheaper.
Well, that's
right. I mean, this is on top of everything else, and this is the thing that I think elected leaders have to be mindful of. I mean, face it, they just went through 5 years of the federal government fire hosing money into the economy by the trillions. We are $36, $37 trillion in debt. I don't even know how the nation survives with that, right? And well, there's the hangover. They said, well, finally, you know, COVID's over. The money's all that COVID money is slowing down, and the cities and the counties and the schools all got addicted to it. And that's where we're at.
But God forbid again that we even think about, you know, getting rid of the crime bus.
Right. So the thing that they should be charging more money for, people would be willing to pay bus fares, right? Just to be able to ride on a safe bus.
The normal people that ride that bus would be more than happy to pay their way.
Right. So the city of TUSD, they hope to raise $45 million through this budget override. They just had an $800 million bond get approved for security upgrades. So you're paying for that. And by the way, TUSD gets more per pupil than people who take their money with them in the form of a school voucher to an ESA, to an educational savings account. So again, everybody coming back and saying, hey, look, we need a little bit more money. Well, have you gone out to eat lately, Greg? It's like a dinner out that not that long ago was maybe $30 to $40 is now easily $50 plus after tip.
No, it's again, we keep beating this, but it's death by 1,000 cuts. It really is for so many consumers out there.
And here's where we're at. So we've got, we've passed all these minimum wage laws because everybody wants people, you know, they put this on the ballot. Don't you want people to make more money? Well, of course we want people to make more money. So they do this and then the prices go up for everybody. And it's just this insidious, you know, spiral. It's maddening. And then we'll come back. We got one more to hit you with when we come back after the break. But again, you're not, you know, whether you got a raise this year, whether you didn't, maybe you want to do something a little bit different with your money. Maybe you want to save some of it. I don't know, for a rainy day, you know, or maybe you want to take a little trip or, you know, anything. Or maybe you want to go out to eat twice a month instead of once a month or twice a week instead of once a week or whatever your situation is or whatever your schedule allows. And here we go. Money, more money, please. More money, please. It is 7:29. As Gary Shandling used to say, no flipping. We're going to be back right after the bottom of the hour news. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. 7:34, you're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. Matt Neely here for Ted Maxwell. I do. As you were queuing that up, I thought, well, that's a great song. I haven't heard it in a while. And how much it sounds like I wear my sunglasses at night.
You know? Well, it was from that same year.
Same era.
1984.
Yeah. Oh, same year even. Huh?
Except I got to admit, the Cars thing was much better.
Absolutely. I think so, too.
The Cars song.
Doesn't drone on and on. 790-2040, if you'd like to get in on the conversation. I do have, Greg, an eagle update. Sonny flew back to the nest. He's on top of the tree trying to figure out how to get back into the nest. And he didn't eat all day yesterday because he fledged before breakfast. And he was over in the other tree, and now he's has to figure out how to kind of aim and land where he wants to land. So this is your Eagle Cam update live from Big Bear, California.
I don't think anybody else in the greater Tucson area is doing a broadcast coverage.
Station.
That's right.
We're the only station in town. So we were talking about the government has its hands in your pocket and wants to put its hands deeper in your pocket, apparently. We talked about the city of Tucson's differential water rates if you don't live inside the city of Tucson. Maybe we should all just sink our own wells. I don't know. We talked about TUSD. They're going to come to you for a budget override. City property tax. It may be an offset. It may not. I somehow think it might not be an offset. And now Pima, let's go on to Pima County. So Pima County residents could see their property taxes increase. This is from a news story last week that we did here on 1030 The Voice. Could see their property tax increase under three new proposals. The flood control district is seeking a 4% hike. Free library district, I don't know, free, it proposes more than a 3% increase, and Pima County is suggesting a 6% rise in primary property taxes. What this all comes down to is they're saying, let's see, a Jan Lesher memo here or a story about the budget, I guess, from Pima County. They're saying the average increase for a Pima County single-family home would be about $94 a year. So they're talking about... they want to spend $26 million on road repair, which that's great. That's a good thing. I'm glad they're doing that. Early education, they now, again, getting back to the COVID hangover thing, they're transitioning funding for the popular and successful Pima Early Education Program, known as PEEP Scholarship, from expiring federal grants that they got addicted to county library. So they're actually going to raise the library, the free library fund, and then they're going to take money out of that for peeps. And then the county established a fund to aid people in danger of being evicted during the pandemic. The board is continuing the important program since. Well, again, nobody wants to be evicted, but they're charging all the rest of us to help prevent some of that. Anyway, $94 a year. So how does this all add up? Well, Now, some of these may be mutually exclusive depending on where you live. I mean, you can't, you maybe some people won't be subject to all of them, but your water bill, that's $96 a year. City of Tucson, who knows what they're going to nail you for on that. Pima County is going to hit you for $94 a year for tax. And TUSD, $17 a month, that's $204 a year. That's about $400 a year, right? That's going, plus whatever the city hits you for.
And, you know, let's think about TUSD for a minute. One of the issues there is these increases hitting residents, it's not helping the city in any way. The district is still going to be, I hate to call it, a poverty district. It's not going to improve the district. You're basically just, you know, limping along. Like, here's some money. Let's throw some money at it to keep it going. I mean, I guess you have to. The schools can't shut down. Mm-hmm. But you see my point.
I do.
There's no improvements. You're handing off more expenses to the city. Right. You know, people here are losing money, but the whole endeavor isn't improving anything. Have we seen any improvement overall with TUSD scores?
The police are still understaffed.
Well, yeah.
The roads, I just, you know, some of them are just in hideous shape in the city and the county, but especially in the city.
And you know what actually gets tough? Going back to sports, I'm not taking it in a sports direction, but you know, one of the places that I spend time is the Big 12 Sports Talk page on Facebook.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the worst thing is that knowing the boys up north and the way they look down in the city.
Okay.
And it's almost like, you know, there's times I want to jump in and say, well, I live in the suburbs, so stop it. I, too, know that Tucson has its problems. But, you know, and there's nice parts of town.
Yeah.
The sunsets are great.
The sunsets are great.
And we've got better food than you.
And a lot of nice people here. So, and, I mean, it's okay.
And you've got homeless encampments in Mesa, for goodness sake.
They do. Well, this is just on top of, you know, parking fees are going up this week downtown. Last week, they passed a thing where park or moderate rentals in the city and parks and rec fees went up. And then you have a city council that looks down their nose on any employer that comes to town, right? They look down their nose. Oh, we don't like this. We don't like Grand Canyon University. We don't like the mine. You know, you go back 50 years. We don't want, which is more of a county issue. We don't want Motorola here. So you can't be picky and choosy, right? And tell us that you need more of our money. When you leaders and the voices in the town that are leading the charge against people that want to come here and create good paying jobs, like a mine in the Santa Rita Mountains that's going to create good paying jobs, or a 4-year university that's going to churn out a lot of nurses that maybe their tuition is less than the U of A, and it would spur some competition by the U of A, or at least give kids an option. Maybe U of A wants to stay where they're at as a research university and not worry about losing some people that make a choice based on price, but at least you would have given residents a choice. And you would have enabled prosperity, and the reason you would add more taxpayers, more people paying into the till and pulling the load to help with public safety, help with parks, help with roads. So this is my thing. You know, on one hand, they're looking down their nose on anybody that doesn't meet the elected leaders' litmus test of employers. Meanwhile, you know, our friends at Worldview, that we were promised 400 jobs. It's 86, I think, the last that live in Pima County. So when the city and county get involved with picking and choosing and deciding who's the right employer to have here, well, I don't think they have a stellar track record. And so don't stop and tell me, right, that you've got all the answers, but we all need to give a little bit more when you've had people, opportunity has been knocking at your door for years, for decades. And you said, we're not the right kind of employer. We don't like it.
You know what we should do?
Yeah.
You can do this post later on Facebook. Okay. I want you to do a post on the KVOI page.
All right.
What businesses would they welcome?
Right.
The Circle of Righteousness.
Right.
The current administration. Like, what businesses exist that they would just bend over backwards to get? So a little tongue-in-cheek, obviously, yeah. A little sarcasm in there, but yeah. I want to welcome all the KBOI listeners to come up and help us make a list, and then we can maybe report that on the air at some point.
We'll put that up a little bit later this morning.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the last thing I want to say on this subject is Rio Nuevo, nice to have, right? And some good things have happened as a result of it. Rio Nuevo is also diverting 50% of the state shared revenues. That's the 5.6% component of our state of our sales tax. It's diverting Rio Nuevo gets half of the sales tax generated in that district to go to its projects that it's funding. Well, if the city of Tucson is really in such dire straits, can we at least have the conversation? Is Rio Nuevo a gotta have or a nice to have? Is it time to reconsider that if the city is really so short on money for public safety, roads, and parks? And I think, I'm not saying it should be ended. I'm just saying, why can't we at least have that conversation? With that, we're going to take a break. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. We're going to come back and talk with Adrian Wuhr from the Hedrick Acres Neighborhood Association about their big court victory and how that makes progress on the homeless encampment situation for their neighborhood and possibly for other people around the city. You're listening to 1030 The Voice. 7:48, you're listening to The Morning Voice. Matt Neely in for Ted Maxwell today. Greg Gehringer on the other side of the glass with the tunes, Your Side of Town, sung by The Killers. Thank you very much, Greg. Today, we're speaking with Adrian Wuhr. Adrian's a Hedrick Acres resident who sued the city, part of a group that sued the city, and won an appeal against the city regarding a longstanding homeless encampment in their neighborhood in what they call the Navajo Wash. The camp had raised concerns about theft, vandalism, health hazards, and illegal drug use. And after a legal back and forth, the city may be ordered to act. We're going to hear more about what happened, how it affected the neighborhood, and what comes next. Adrian, thanks for calling in today. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you doing it. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation in your neighborhood leading up to the lawsuit?
Yeah, we've had homeless in Navajo Wash off and on for 5 or 10 years, but it got markedly worse about 4 years ago. That was when the city started providing the homeless with tents and tarps so they could camp there year-round, rather than just in the winter time when it was a little cooler. And so when we filed the lawsuit in 2022, we had probably 20 people there camping 24/7, no bathroom facilities. So, you know, we had fires, we had shopping carts filled with trash, we had human waste, and we had drug paraphernalia, syringes, foils, pipes, that sort of thing.
Adrian, what was the moment that you felt that calls to the city weren't going anywhere and you had to take it to court?
Well, the legal action was our last resort, but we did a letter writing campaign. The neighborhood probably sent in 50 to 100 letters to the Ward 3 office, to the mayor's office, and two other officials that have some authority in that area, the homeless outreach and so forth. And we weren't getting any response. And in fact, one of our residents went to meet with Kevin Dahl and said that all of our letters were used as wallpaper in his conference room, almost as a badge of honor. And so we just thought, you know, they're not even responding to our letters. We're getting blown off. And so last resort really was to take legal action.
Adrian, this may be an obvious question, but what is it that you're asking the city to do?
We've been asking them to ban the homeless camps in the Wash so that we can have the pocket park as it's intended to be, open for everyone. And they currently do that in a lot of washes that have high flows. Because of the risk to first responders who have to go in there when the people overdose and so forth. They do it around schools. We have a nursery school within the length requirement that would force them to clear out the camps. So they changed the length requirement. And, you know, just it would be so easy for them to do. And so that's what we're asking them to do.
Tell us a little bit about the you initially losing the lawsuit and appealing it. Tell us about how that went. And if the city has done anything since you won the appeal.
So yeah, after the lower court ruling, which we lost, it was very frustrating. And one of our plaintiffs gave up and moved out of Tucson. She just couldn't take it anymore. That's Allison Bradford.
That's one way of dealing with the problem.
Yeah, but you know, it's not fair for the elderly right. who are on fixed incomes in our neighborhood. It's not fair to the people with kids in school who don't have the liberty to decide where they want to move, you know, at the drop of a hat. So, you know, since I represented the neighborhood and the foremost goal of the neighborhood association is to improve the quality of life for our residents and business owners, I didn't think that this was something I could just turn my back on. And so, you know, we found legal representation. We hoped that just by writing them a letter listing all of the laws they were breaking, it would bring them to the negotiation table. But the mayor didn't even respond. Kevin Dahl did acknowledge that, but they didn't negotiate in good faith, even when ordered to by the court. And so here we are. You know, we've had a second court ruling that found in our favor, and we're waiting to hear from the city to see how they want to respond.
How do you think that the city could address some of the challenges that they have? I mean, obviously we hear that the city of Tucson is buying up a lot of old hotels and fixing them up into what they call low barrier housing. There's organizations around town that are out that have beds available to help. How do you think that the city can, what suggestions do you have for the city, how they can deal with some of this?
Right. It's a good question. First, there, as you point out, there are enough shelter beds right now for every homeless individual on the street.
Wow.
Over the last 2 years, what we have been seeing in Pima County and Tucson is a decrease in the number of sheltered homeless, those who accept help and go into shelters, and an increase in unsheltered homeless, those who are service resistant is the term, who will not go into a shelter and do not want help. And so because more and more people are refusing shelter, we have more and more shelter beds available, but nobody's taking them.
Is the refusal of shelter sometimes a reflection that they don't want to get sober?
I think it is. I mean, addiction's a tough one to beat. And sometimes it takes more than being nice to somebody to win them over. So, you know, we have a transition center where people can go and be safe and sober up and then make good decisions about their life in the future. That's a good start.
If you could talk to city leaders or county, you got a platform right now. We've got about a minute. What would you like for them to understand about what you've had to deal with and how it's come to this, that you have to force their hand to deal with something that's kind of part of their job? What would you like to tell city and county leaders?
Well, yeah, we shouldn't have to go into a long, lengthy, expensive legal battle to get the government to do their job. I would like to see a serious conversation about banning homeless camps in business and residential neighborhoods. Maybe the sanctioned campground idea on the outskirts of the city with transportation to services within the city is a good idea. While they work on the housing first approach.
Yep. Well, I hope this encourages other neighborhoods that are dealing with this. I know we got folks along 29th Street that have to deal with this stuff from the folks along Golf Links, the 100 Acre Woods. So, and I know there's a lot of stuff that, a lot of others that are in the same situation. I hope that they kind of take strength and see that you're showing them the path forward. So thanks for what you did and what you're doing.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time, Adrian.
Mm-hmm.
You listen
to do it.
Thanks. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We'll be back right after a break for the news with the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona. Good morning. It's 8:03. I am not Ted Maxwell. I'm Matt Neely. Ted's having a well-deserved summer vacation, and I will be sitting in for him today. Ben Buehler-Garcia is going to be sitting in for him next Tuesday. So, Ted, wherever you are, we're hoping you're having a great time and it's enjoying some well-deserved time off and hopefully not in the desert heat. The Morning Voice is a unique program. We have five different hosts, one each day. Lydia Aranda on Monday with Rainmakers. Yesterday, she had a great conversation with the community food banks. Kendall from the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona. Ted Maxwell, Tuesdays with Civic Engagement. Grant Kruger, Wednesday with Food for Thought. Tom Moulton on Thursdays with the local attractions and tourism and all sorts of fun things that you need to know about. You can visit and take your friends and family to. And then Friday, we close out the week with Dr. Ed Ackerley, who talks about business success stories and all the neat things happening at the University of Arizona. He calls it U of A Wonder Stories. It is 8:04. I'm pleased to welcome Marie Fortney, the executive director of the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona. I've heard twice recently in sexual abuse crimes against minors that plea deals have been offered to avoid re-traumatizing the victim. And today we have Marie here to discuss. Tell us what the Children's Advocacy Center is all about and how you can help bring people to justice and also help healing. Mm-hmm. So welcome, Marie.
Thanks. I appreciate it. That our whole goal at the Children's Advocacy Center is to reduce trauma. So this is perfectly appropriate to connect these two stories. What we do really, the easiest way is to tell you a brief story. So I'm going to do that. But we wrap families with services. And that's because when something like this happens, it can be really devastating to the entire family. So for example, a young girl named Ashley, who was being sexually abused by her dad, was brought to the Children's Advocacy Center by law enforcement. And DCS was also there because it was her dad. And she got a forensic interview and an exam. And it's really important that we provide that. That's part of what we do. Because we can reduce the trauma, we have specially trained professionals who are experts in gathering that data in a way that keeps the child from really being re-victimized and having to tell that story over and over again.
Multiple times.
Right. Or having to get their medical care in an emergency room, for example. So that's the first step. And then the second step really is the conversation with Ashley's mom. She was also struggling. It really does upend the entire family. She was shocked. She felt guilty for what her husband had done. And then she had this moment of panic because she realized she's going to have to pay all the bills now. So our advocates work with these families, help them calm all those emotions, and then make sure they have all those resources in place. And then they stay on the healing journey with the families. They can join our support groups. They can call back anytime for anything they need. And the idea is that we're going to be there with them through the long haul and make sure that kids like Ashley can heal.
Do you deal specifically, are some of your clients up to the age of 18, or are they all younger children, or what's kind of the mix of the people you're dealing with?
All the 0 to 18
really?
Is so, the age range.
Yeah,
the full spectrum. If a child is really too young to tell their story through a forensic interview, then they'll just have the exam. And so their body can kind of tell the story, you know, if there are injuries or malnutrition that indicates neglect or anything like that. And then we do go beyond 18 for adults who are, the official term is vulnerable adults. Mm-hmm. They're adults with developmental delays, mm-hmm. or something that makes our child-friendly approach appropriate for them.
And when you talk about, can you tell us a little bit more about the term forensic interview and mm-hmm. what that sort of entails?
Yeah, it's not therapeutic. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why families can't self-refer to the Children's Advocacy Center.
Okay.
You can only be brought to the Children's Advocacy Center if there's an investigation. So to give an example, there are about 9,000 investigations into child abuse every year in Pima County. We only see about 1,000 of those. And it, yeah, 9,000 is 9, a lot. 000. I see your facial expression on that one. It is a lot. It's sad. It's happening, unfortunately, every day. And it's really hard to talk about that, but we just can't ignore that. It's right there in front of us. And sometimes it is so intense that we have to get involved. Mm-hmm. And so a forensic interview really is a conversation. It allows the child the space they need to tell what has or hasn't happened. It's a lot of open-ended questions. Forensic interviewers have hundreds of hours of training before they even conduct their first interview. And ours are all bilingual as well. Mm-hmm. So the idea being to create the most comfort for the child, ask them open-ended questions so that they can tell about what has happened in their own words. And it goes with law enforcement or child welfare investigations to investigators to help with their investigation and their pursuit of justice in that way. If it is going to go to trial, or there might be for child welfare, they might be having to determine whether that child is safe in that home, mm-hmm. or if they need to move to a different home. So the interview supports that decision-making process.
Does the forensic interview approach the level of a deposition, or do things gleaned in the forensic interview, does that help in the court case, or do they have to kind of go on the stand? I mean, does this work as a deposition, or is it in place of? Or
that's a really good question. It's very starkly different from a deposition in that there's nothing that could be felt as an attack to the child. It's so mm-hmm. open-ended. You know, it's not direct, why did you do this or anything like that, because we all know it's not that child's fault anyway. And then the interview is used by both sides of the aisle mm-hmm. in making decisions about filing motions. The judge can see it. It often is not played in the trial mm-hmm. except to help the child recall what they had said in the interview. And that's just statewide. Our state has determined that that interview is considered hearsay. And so the child does often have to testify. But the really great thing about this whole process, which we call a multidisciplinary team process, mm-hmm. it's law enforcement and prosecutors and child welfare and service providers and all of us at the Children's Advocacy Center working together to keep the healing for that child top of mind.
Sure.
So the child will be called to testify if it's going to help the case and it's going to be empowering to the child. Sometimes it's really amazing for a young person to sit on that stand and say exactly what happened and to tell their accuser that they know that was not okay. Not their accuser, their abuser.
Their abuser,
Totally wrong word. but sometimes that wouldn't be so helpful to the child. And so there are other ways to get around that kind of.
We're speaking with Marie Fordney from the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona about how they can help kids that have been in just very unfortunate situations of abuse and how they can kind of help put the pieces back together. Does the person that they have formed a relationship that they've kind of opened up to in a forensic interview, does that person show up in the courtroom if it comes to that, so that they know they've got somebody there that they've spoken to? I mean, is that sort of part of the whole services that
like
you provide?
The model. It's not necessarily part of the model, although the interviewer could go if mm-hmm. the child wants that. More often, it's the advocate that goes. And we have an advocate at the Children's Advocacy Center. That's the person who meets with the caregiver, the non-offending caregiver. And then there are also advocates at the county attorney's office. And they're much more specialist. While we are specialists in the investigation in those initial phases, they are specialists in the trial and the court process. So they form a relationship with the kids after our part has concluded, and they can help them understand what's going to happen next, the kinds of questions that might be asked, because they are in that courtroom all the time. And the other really cool thing is that we in Pima County have a courthouse dog program. There are these dogs that are specially trained to be able to be in the courtroom. The kids spend enough time with the dogs that they're considered secondary handlers mm-hmm. for the dog, and then the dog can be laying at their feet while they're testifying. And that's super comforting and helps them be able to keep their own emotional response low while they're telling about what's probably the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
It's amazing how therapeutic animals can be in general. You have Trot and Track and mm-hmm. you know,
the courthouse dogs.
Animals, yeah. You know, animals don't judge, and animals just give that unconditional love. So you kind of broached the subject and it just made me think, we're talking about things that are governed by state law. How does Arizona compare to other states in terms of advocacy for kids, in terms of court procedures, in terms of how motions and charges and testimony is given? How do we compare? Are there things that Arizona could be doing that are more enlightened? How do we compare to other states?
So statewide, actually, we're in really good shape. We have advocates available for pretty much every community. The main issue is that in Southern Arizona, there are not as many advocacy centers as there are in Maricopa County, for example. Mm-hmm. In Maricopa County, there's one for almost every jurisdiction, Gilbert and Chandler and Tempe and Mesa and Phoenix. And here we have our Children's Advocacy Center in Tucson, and we serve Cochise, Graham, Greenlee, Pima, and Santa Cruz counties, which is 23,000 square miles. So the accessibility of services is really kind of the issue. But almost every county attorney has some kind of advocacy that they're employing that helps support families through that court process itself.
We are speaking with Marie Fordney from the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona. It is 8:15. We're going to take a little break for some commercials and traffic and fun stuff like that. As Gary Shandling said, no flipping. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Morning Voice.
This is a great piece of music from 1996. In honor of the Children's Advocacy Center. This is Robert Miles and Children.
20 minutes after 8 o'clock, you're listening to The Morning Voice. Matt Neely in for Ted Maxwell this week. And we are speaking with Marie Fordney from the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona. And we're talking about forensic interviews and how the Advocacy Center can help children to not be re-traumatized and get kids out of a bad situation in their life where they're being abused and get them on the road to recovery. So welcome back, Marie.
Thanks. I really appreciate coming.
So we were talking about forensic interviews and gaining the trust and getting the kids to open up. That's for somebody that's kind of taking you up on your offer. And you also said, just to reset for everybody, that you're not self-referred there. You're referred to by law enforcement or maybe the county attorney's office as part of a case, right?
That or DCS.
Oh, DCS. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, right.
Yep.
Yeah. So I was curious, are there any obstacles you have to overcome? So the family is referred to you, mm-hmm. the non-abusing parent,
right,
and the kid are referred mm-hmm. to you. Are there any obstacles? They come in and said, this isn't for us. I mean, are there obstacles mm-hmm. you routinely have to overcome? I'm sure every case is different, but are there any common hurdles you have to get back to begin that healing process?
Usually they understand why they're coming and that we're on their side. You know, what we want is what's best for the child. Mm-hmm. And we want to know what really did or didn't happen. But sometimes families come in, they don't really know why they're there, especially teenagers might think that they're in trouble. We had one little girl who thought she was in trouble because she had run away after being terribly abused by her parents, and she had run to her aunt's house and said, I don't care if I get in trouble, but I can't go back there. And very quickly, once she walked in the door, she knew that we were on her side, and not like on her side, but we were there to support her. And we were there to just give her what she needed and make sure that she could heal and that we weren't going to make her go back to a dangerous situation. And so that's one of the most common. The other can be, you know, that Kids don't really want to talk about what's happened. You know, this is probably the worst thing that's ever happened. In the case of sexual abuse, it's also surrounded with secrecy and shame.
Sure.
And the child is made to feel that somehow they're responsible for what's happened. And so it does take very special skill. And that's why our forensic interviewers get so much training to really create a space where the kids and young people can share what has happened. And with no blame, you know, a child is never to blame for what has happened for them. They might be made to feel that way, but it's never their fault. And it's just shocking to me, Matt, how many times a child needs to hear that it was not their fault.
Really? You just need to reinforce that to them.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there's just a lot of shame in that, that they have to deal with, that they shouldn't have to deal with.
Right.
But they feel that this is what they've...
Yeah.
Like somehow they played a part in this or something, right? And that's not the case.
No.
It's absolutely not the case.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about family advocacy. You hit upon that in the first segment. Obviously, if you're dealing with somebody who's maybe the breadwinner of the family, right? All of a sudden, they have a lot of power over things because they know that maybe if the other spouse isn't making money or isn't making much money, that they're sort of trapped there. So tell us a little bit about your family advocacy services and some of the things you deal with there.
Yeah. Sometimes the reason why a situation has gotten so intense is because of that kind of financial control. And we also see a lot of intersection between child abuse and domestic violence, that the person who is controlling money, controlling people, and abusing the kids is also abusing, you know, everybody in the house. And so it does take, the advocacy really starts as a conversation. It's technically called crisis intervention, where you help that non-offending caregivers, what we call them, help them calm down their emotions and figure out what they need so that they can move forward without that abuser. Maybe they are paying all the bills. And so now if you put yourself in that position, now you have to get a different job or a better job or ask for more hours. Maybe you need a different place to live that's more affordable for you. And we have things we can...
And of course, with housing going up so much over the last 5 years, boy, that's just a bigger hurdle, right?
Right, right. Well, and you were just talking about the unhoused in the previous segment, that there are so many obstacles. If you could just real quick, Matt, solve the housing crisis, that would be really helpful. So that's my task for you to do today.
People would feel that they'd have a... I'll work on that
just
this afternoon.
Just go ahead, you know, and then cure cancer and we'll be all set.
But it's a safety outlet for people to be able to get to a new house and a new apartment or something like that.
It's part of the safety plan sometimes. And we can, in the moment, hand families a lot of things because we have a lot of generous donors. We have gas cards, grocery gift cards. We have clothing and toiletries and backpacks. You know, when a child leaves their home for this interview, they might not realize they're never going home again. And so they didn't pack a toothbrush.
Sure.
You know, so we have all of those kinds of things on site, but then we connect them to long-term resources because the idea is that these families should build their own independence and be able to move forward and know that they can move forward on their own and not end up feeling like they have to be reliant on someone else who maybe is kind of a jerk to them.
We're talking with Marie Fordney from the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona. I know part of your mission is prevention, right?
Yes.
So I see two things on your site. And one I'm really encouraged to see is that you do training for mandatory child abuse reporters. We won't talk about that and safe sleep. So could you tell us about those two?
Sure. Safe sleep I'll talk about first because it's pretty quick. That's to address, from our perspective, sometimes an unsafe sleeping situation for an infant is a condition of neglect. And it's that the family is willfully not giving that child a good place to sleep. But also there are a lot of unnecessary tragedies that occur if people don't know the ABCs of safe sleep, which is alone, on their back, and in a crib that doesn't have anything else in it. So That's the safe sleep. The mandatory reporter training is one of my favorite programs that we have. We're unique as a child advocacy center, even in the country, because half of our budget is dedicated to prevention. We're very serious about not wanting kids to ever get to us in the first
place. Way better to deal with it before it happens.
Right, sure. For sure. If we can, if people can take this mandatory reporter training and they recognize the signs of abuse and neglect and they make the report early before it's really intense, then there can be an intervention. Something can happen to support that family or to remove the person that shouldn't be in that home and make it safer for that child. And then they never get all the way to these intense situations that disrupt their home and their life and their schooling. And instead, they could be safe in their own home with that non-offending caregiver.
And that's really the mandatory reporter training that really goes out into the community, because there's so many organizations, scouting and organizations that do things with school kids where people need that training. So that is really a chance for you to branch out and widely into broadly into the community, is it not?
Yeah. Yeah. And we have it available online too, because there are so many organizations that need that training. In the state of Arizona, if you work with kids, you are required to make mandatory reports. And so you need that training to know what you're looking at. Sometimes poverty looks like neglect, but really it's just that family needs more support. And people should be able to recognize bruising or when a child really withdraws or stops caring for their hygiene. Those can be signs of abuse too. And if you learn how to recognize those signs and know how to make that report, then we can keep kids safe.
Marie, we're heading for a break real soon. Tell folks how they can help the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona.
Go to our website, cacsoaz.org. You can learn more and you can make a donation. Like I said, we really rely on the community to support some of those things that we hand directly to families that they so desperately need.
Marie, thanks for your time today. Say hi to our good friend, Alan Michaels. We appreciate you, all the good things that you and your team are doing for the community.
Thank you so much, Matt.
We're heading to the bottom of the hour news. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We're going to be speaking with the Sons of Confederate Veterans coming up right after the news. As Gary Shandling says, no flipping. Thanks for the setup on Southern Voice by Tim McGraw. Thank you very much.
I totally failed. I had your mic off for a second, but you got the Southern Voice part in there. See, this is what makes me appreciate what you do day in and day out. Because I come in here and I'm like, oh, man, I'm doing great. And then sure as can be,
it's like riding a bike. You get a few reps in and you're back speeding down the mountain. It's okay. You're doing a great job, as always.
Thank you, sir.
So we are welcoming Ed Carnes, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, this morning. Ed, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Good morning to you too, Matt. Appreciate your opportunity to be here.
Yeah.
The Sons of Confederate Veterans, go back a little bit in the history. In 1889, well, before that, just after the war, many veterans got together in different locations in the country, or in the South, and they formed their own little camps, their own little organizations. In 1889, the United Confederate Veterans were formed to consolidate all these little camps, all these little sections of the country into one organization. That was 1889. And they made their purpose, and I like to read to you the purpose, what they made, because I think people don't understand who we are and where we came from. So I'd like to kind of share with that if I could.
Sure.
The purpose, in 1889, they declared their purpose was emphatically non-military and to foster social, literary, historical, and benevolent ends. Also, they told the 1896 UCV Annual Convention that their organization was not formed to malice or in mischief, in disaffection or in rebellion, not to keep alive sectional hates, not to awaken revenge for defeat, nor to kindle disloyalty to the Union. Rather, the recognition of the glorious deeds of our comrades is perfectly consistent with loyalty to the flag and devotion to the Constitution and the resulting Union. returned. They also agreed to return to the Union as an equal and B remains in the Union as a friend, with no humble apologies, no unmanly servitude, nor petty spite, no sullen treachery. He is a cheerful, frank citizen of the United States, accepting the present, trusting the future, and proud of the past. So that's what the whole thing was in the beginning, is they wanted to be a part of the country. They wanted to be a part of everything without being recognized as an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part of it being historical and literary, that's what the start was in 1889. As the soldiers began to die off, and 1896 in Richmond, Virginia, they formed the Sons of the Confederate Veterans, which is the what we are today, the Sons. The 1951, the United Confederate Veterans had their last reunion in Richmond, Virginia, because there are only three people attended.
And when was this?
In 1951.
Wow.
In Richmond, Virginia. Wow. Arizona sent a contingent of sons of Confederate veterans to Richmond with horses, and they had a huge parade. I mean, it was a big deal. Back in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 30s, the conventions were a big deal in cities and towns that they were held in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they had 100,000 members and families to attend, and other individuals to attend these conventions. So it was a big thing at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1951, they ceased because they had no more veterans to attend.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, and that's where our camp in Tucson started, in the Sons of Confederate Veterans. We are the oldest camp in the state of Arizona. But anyway, when I was back years ago, I had two uncles that had letters from my great-great-great uncle. He joined the Confederacy, joined the Confederate Army in 1861, and he rose to the rank of sergeant. He went to Gettysburg with Lee, and in Gettysburg, in the retreat, he was captured by the Union forces. He was sent to Fort McHenry. He was sent to Point Lookout, Maryland, as his last one, after going to Fort Delaware. And there he died just 6 months after he was captured. So they had this information for me, and I became more and more interested in it as time went along. And so what I did was start researching myself, looking at my family history. And I find that there's probably, right now I can have write down 20 names of my ancestors that fought in the Confederacy.
Hmm.
Being from Virginia, most people did fight for the Confederacy. Now, what people don't understand is that Virginia didn't secede at first with South Carolina and the other. So they went against secession, I think, two or three times before Abraham Lincoln says he needs an army of 50,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to go in through, because Virginia hadn't seceded, they were going through Virginia to get to South Carolina, Georgia, Florida,
mm-hmm.
and which is against the Constitution at that time. People don't understand the culture at that time is entirely different.
Okay.
Sometimes I ask people, what would you do if you lived in the 1850s and 1860s in the South? What would you do if war came? And, you know, they said, well, I don't know. That's it. We don't know. We can't say for sure why things happened the way they did, but they did. So we now have six camps here in the state of Arizona, active camps.
Was all of Arizona in the South? I mean, I know Tucson was part of the South.
It was. At one time in 1862.
It was a territory at the time.
As a territory. The Arizona territory. The capital was Mesilla, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's going to be
so,
two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Tucson was part of the Confederacy, the Confederate territory. The people were tired of all the raids from the Indians at the time, Native Americans. They were being killed. they were being captured and made slaves of. The Indians did.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1862, the Confederacy came and said they wanted a pathway to the Pacific so they could bring supplies in and for the South.
Mm-hmm.
And they came as far as Tucson. And in Tucson, they set up their regimental or headquarters here in Tucson itself. It only lasted a few months, but it was here. Eventually, the skirmish and battle of Picacho Peak took place. Parts of the California column was on its way east to go to Texas, and some of the Confederate army attacked, or not an attack, but they engaged the Union forces there at Picacho Peak. There were like 4 Union soldiers killed and no Confederates.
Mm-hmm.
They went back to Tucson and they found out that they needed to go back. They needed to go ahead and go back to Texas because they had a California column coming before them.
I see.
I want to jump in with that real quick. I love the fact you brought up Picacho Peak, Ed. One of the things you also mentioned, you talked about the Indian raids on Tucson, but you might elaborate and talk about the fact that one of the reasons people in Tucson were so angry was that all these Union installations were abandoned. They were all heading back to the east, and they basically left the people of Tucson and southern Arizona at different forts. They're like, okay, we're gone. Goodbye. You deal with it.
That's exactly right. What took place was the war had started. The Union called their forces back from the west, including California Column and the ones in Arizona itself. And as they left, the people were unprotected. And so as the Confederates came west to open up that western to the ocean, western mm-hmm. trail to the ocean, they took over. People voted them in. It wasn't a big vote. I mean, 70 said yes and mm-hmm. maybe 30 said no. But anyway, they raised the flag, First National Flag, in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And they were here for a number of times. But yes, the Union forces that were here guarding and protecting the settlers had to move east. And so as the Confederates tried to move west, Picacho Peak was the place that they engaged the Union forces.
Yep. Wow. 8:45, we're speaking with Ed Carnes with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Fascinating discussion. We will be right back. Thank you, Greg, with the music. Sal's going to do it again by Charlie Daniels. We'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to The Morning Voice. 8:50, you're listening to The Morning Voice. Heading into the last section, last segment of the show. We're speaking with Ed Carnes with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Ed, talk a little bit about the circumstances of Southern soldiers. I understand, especially later in the war, the conscription was they were compelled, legally compelled, with threat of jail to serve in the Confederacy. Can you talk a little bit about that? And is that part of your family's story?
It's not part of my family's story because he went ahead and enlisted anyway.
Uh-huh.
But yes, you have to understand the Army was a Union Army, a Northern Army. It was for the whole North, South, East, and West.
Mm-hmm.
The South had no army except for militia groups. States were the citizens' government at that time. And so they had their own militias in each state. And when the war started, all the militias were called in, and they formed the Confederate States Army.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no manufacturing. The South had no manufacturing like the North did. So they started behind in the war as far as manpower, cannons, rifles, the whole thing. They started behind. So, yeah, conscription came along in 1862. It was getting to the point near the end of the war where they direly needed manpower. And so people were conscripted. Older people were conscripted. Younger people were conscripted. And that's the way the war ended. So, yes, there was conscription in the Confederate Army at that time. One thing I like to say is that, going back to what I was saying before the break, is that people do not know the Sons of Confederate Veterans. They do not know who we are mm-hmm. and why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
We are a historical group. We try to incorporate our thoughts and history to people, mm-hmm. convey it to them. Our whole thing is to bring out our history, our heritage. Should I forget about the 20, 30 people that are my ancestors that fought in Confederacy? Should I just cast them aside as an enemy or somebody I don't want to be associated with? No, it's my heritage. And so I will always be that way. It's a passion for me right now. One thing I'd like to, if it's okay with you, get into is what we're trying to do right now. In 2021, the NDAA, Senator Warren, they had a naming commission, formed a naming commission, and they started looking at all things Confederate, everything Confederate. They said Confederates did not warrant, Confederate monuments, names did not warrant their position in the Department of Defense assets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they started looking at that, and everything they did was to destroy the heritage and the history of the Confederates. So, you know, we're right now we have petitions that we've got signed that we're going to present to the Congressional Delegation of Arizona, especially Abe Hamadeh, who is he's on the Armed Services Committee.
Mm-hmm.
He's also a Army Reservist. So everybody thinks that he's the one we need to contact, and he's the one we're now approaching with the petitions mm-hmm. to restore the battle streamers that were taken away in 19 and 2023 by the Naming Commission. The battle streamers on the Southern National Guard units, colors,
mm-hmm.
Represented battles that were won by the Confederacy. They were on the colors for over 70 years, 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taken away in August of 2023. So right now what we're trying to do is get those streamers back on the colors of the Southern National Guard units, Army National Guard. Like I said, we have our petition has been signed by tons of people, and we're going to present that to Congressman Hamadeh. Eli Crane says that he would be the best person to go to for us to get an amendment to the NDAA to restore those battle streamers. It's a very simple thing. You take them out of the box and put them back on the colors. This doesn't take a lot of money. About a year or so ago, a congressman in Georgia said they wanted the Reconciliation Monument restored to its present place or in Arlington National Cemetery.
Yeah.
Every one of Arizona's Republican congressional unit voted for it.
Yeah.
Except for one. And the reason for that was it cost too much taxpayer money to restore it.
Yeah.
But they took taxpayer money to put it down. So,
thanks for your time, Ed. Our time is up. All right. Appreciate you taking the time to tell us about the Sons of Confederate Veterans. I'd like to thank Adrian Wehr from the Hedrick Acres Neighborhood Association, Marie Fordney with the Children's Advocacy Center of Southern Arizona, and Ed Carnes with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Thanks to Greg Gerringer for helping me out today. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Grant Krueger with Food for Thought. Win Tucson with Kathleen Wynn coming up right after a quick break for the news. Stay tuned. No flipping.